Welcome to the March Dermatologic Surgery Podcast and Beyond the Digest Supplemental Podcast. I am the podcast editor, Naomi Lawrence. In this month's Derm Surgery Podcast, we have a systematic review evaluating studies on the motivations for seeking cosmetic procedures, which focuses on interpersonal, social, and behavioral factors which influence a person's choice to have a cosmetic procedure. In Beyond the Digest, we have a research letter on National Cancer Database, which identified independent predictors for positive central lymph node biopsy in sebaceous carcinoma, and another research letter from Mayo Clinic, which identifies primary cutaneous melanoma features which predict development of in-transit metastases. As always, thank you for listening and have a happy surgery day.
This segment of the episode features surgical oncology and reconstructive article reviews.
This is Ashley Decker, and I'm reviewing the editorial, What is Dermatologic Oncology, by Drs. Joanna Dong and Dr. William Hanke. In this editorial, the authors discuss briefly the history of dermatologic oncology fellowships. The first one-year fellowship training program with a focus on skin cancer was started in 1970 by Dr. Perry and focused on the specialized technique of Mohs surgery developed by Frederick Mohs in the 30s. Over time, the subspecialty expanded to include reconstruction, cosmetics, laser procedures, and oncologic therapeutics. Over the years, the fellowship has undergone several name changes, with the most recent change in 2014 to micrographic surgery and dermatologic oncology to better describe the scope of practice. The number of ACGME fellowships has increased from 5 in 2004 to its current total of 79. In 2021, it became a board-certified subspecialty. This subspecialty is part of a broader specialty of oncology. There are many ACGME-approved specialties or subspecialties with a focus on cancer diagnosis and management. Some of these specialties require board certification, while others do not. I invite the listeners to read or to review the tables in this article for a comprehensive list of specialties involved in oncologic care.
This is Erica Levitt reviewing the original article, Refining the Classification of Field Cancerization, by authors Beau Cottrell and Adam Sutton. The purpose of this study was to propose a disease classification framework and chemoprevention guidance for field cancerization patients. The authors provide the background that field cancerization is very common, but poorly defined. One previously proposed definition is multifocal clinical atypia characterized by actinic keratoses or SEC in situ, with or without invasion, occurring in a field exposed to chronic UV radiation. The authors used this definition as a starting point and then proposed a stratification system with 5 classes. They also proposed chemo prevention guidance based on both the author's clinical expertise as well as literature review. Class 1 in the proposed system is limited field cancerization with only 1 to 4 AKs. Treatment for this class includes cryotherapy and 5 fluorouracil. Class 2 is defined as field cancerization as defined above, with the multifocal atypia with AKs or SECs in situ in a chronically sun-damaged field. Recommended chemo prevention and treatment includes photodynamic therapy, 5-FU, or imiquimod with optional chemo wraps if on the extremities. Class 3 includes patients with a history of 2 or more low-risk keratinocyte carcinomas. Recommended chemo prevention includes niacinamide 500 milligrams twice daily. Class 4 is patients with 5 or more lifetime keratinocyte carcinomas meeting criteria for skin cancer as a chronic disease, or 2 or more low-risk skin cancers within 1 year. Chemo prevention includes daily acitretin if the cancers are SCC predominant, or imiquimod cycles or cyclical PDT if BCC predominant. The highest risk class, class 5, includes patients with 2 or more high-risk skin cancers that are Brigham staging system T2B or greater, or 4 skin cancers that are T2A stage or greater. For this class, Chemo prevention guidance is to consider capecitabine in conjunction with oncology. All of this above information is summarized very well in the paper's Table 1. Overall, this is a very interesting and useful classification system and treatment algorithm that may help us better characterize and treat patients with diffuse skin cancer and photodamage as we see daily in dermatology. I am very interested in the future work by this group assessing the utility of this system and treatment protocols, and they have already started a prospective study evaluating patients in the highest risk classes.
This is Deirdre Connolly reviewing the reconstructive conundrum, repair of a large multi-subunit temple, zygomatic cheek, and lateral eyelid defect. First author, Tuyet Nguyen. Senior author, Nima Garavi. An 83-year-old male underwent Mohs surgery for a basal cell carcinoma on the right temple, lateral eyelid, and zygomatic cheek. After six stages of Mohs, the postoperative defect measured 6 by 6.5 centimeters and affected almost the entire temple and zygomatic cheek and extended onto the forehead, brow, and periorbital subunits. The medial portion of the defect involved the upper and lower eyelid. Logical repair considerations such as transposition flaps utilizing the laxity of the neck and lower cheek would result in transferring hair-bearing skin and would also lead to a concern for tension vectors causing ectropion. Additionally, the patient was anticoagulated, so a large flap mobilizing distant tissue would increase the risk of bleeding and hematoma formation. A Mercedes advancement flap, otherwise known as a triple advancement flap, with Burroughs grafts was designed using the tissue reservoir from the forehead, lateral temple, and cheek. The author's design of the Mercedes flap allowed for redirection of tension away from the free margin of the eyelid to prevent any distortion or asymmetry. In this case, the Mercedes advancement flap was a useful option to reduce the defect size while allowing for Burroughs triangles from the flap to be used to close the residual defect. The repair offered a simple but effective method for repairing this large multi-subunit defect, especially in the context of the patient's comorbidities and anticoagulation.
This is Ashley Decker reviewing the reconstructive conundrum, management of an upper cutaneous and vermilion lip defect by Drs. Bailey and Tsai. In this reconstructive conundrum, the authors present a case of an 85-year-old woman with a basal cell carcinoma on the right upper lip, removed with three stages and leaving a final defect of 2.9 by 1.8 centimeters, and involved the right upper cutaneous lip and vermilion lip. Lips are a prominent facial feature that is vital to both the aesthetics and function. Defects involving multiple subunits are more challenging to repair, and it is important to consider lip symmetry, maintenance of the vermilion border, and oral competency. There are limited reconstructive options that address defects involving both the cutaneous and vermilion lip. Wedge excisions are a viable option for defects involving less than 40% of the upper lip. However, if the defect spans more than that, there is an increased risk of microstomia. Wedge excision can also displace the Cupid's bow and philtrum. There are multi-subunit repairs that can be considered, including advancement of the vermilion lip and a V2Y of the cutaneous lip. However, multi-subunit repairs are more complex and have less reliable results than a reconstruction with a single flap. In this article, the authors use a single V2Y advancement flap encompassing both the cutaneous and vermilion lip to repair the multi-subunit upper lip defect. First, the vermilion lip is carefully marked on both sides of the defect, as this anatomic landmark is easily obscured with anesthesia and lifting of the flap. The flap is designed similarly to the V2Y for a cutaneous lip alone, with a few specific considerations. When marking the superior cutaneous incision of the flap, it is designed to extend parallel to the vermilion border and begins tapering lateral to the oral commissure in order to replace the full height of the cutaneous defect. The inferior incision should extend from the inferior portion of the defect, taper towards the oral commissure, and then continue past the oral commissure to meet the superior incision. Special attention should be placed in the alignment of the vermilion border. In larger defects, a small section of full thickness lip may need to be excised to prevent a tissue cone from protruding into the oral commissure. The authors point out that this flap is an elegant single flap reconstruction with reliable cosmetic results. I usually find that I repair these defects using the multi-subunit approach, but I'm excited to try this in the future.
This is Christy Regula, reviewing the reconstructive conundrum, Reconstruction of the Nasal Ala After Failure of an Interpolated Cheek-to-Nose Flap by first author Yancy Algarin and senior author Vishal Patel. This is the case of a 73-year-old man who presented for Mohs surgery of a recurrent basal cell carcinoma on the left nasal ala. Margins were clear after four stages, and the resultant defect measured 1.5 by 1 centimeter and extended to the level of the mucosa and cartilage. The defect was repaired with a cartilage batten graft and a paranasal interpolation flap. At 3 weeks, the patient returned for flap takedown, and unfortunately, he had full-thickness necrosis of the tip of the nasal ala. The full-thickness necrotic tissue was removed with sharp dissection to reveal the new defect. The proximal aspect of the tissue pedicle luckily had taken well to the superior aspect of the original defect, so the new defect involved only the distal ala. The proximal aspect of the original pedicle was then used as a new pedicle for reconstruction of the now distal aspect of the ala. The pedicle was first severed, and the proximal portion was used as a hinge flap and turned like a book page to angle towards the alar defect. There was some limitations to the mobility of the pedicle due to the thick stalk that had occurred with the 3 weeks of granulation tissue that had built up. So a tip that I found interesting was that they scored the underside of the pedicle almost to butterfly the area to extend the reach of that pedicle a bit more. It was then able to reach the distal alar rim, and the new pedicle was folded over to recreate that alar rim. The exposed dermis from the underside of the pedicle was then thinned, and the overlying ala was allowed to granulate. At 1 week, the sutures were removed and the flap had good vascularity. At 2 weeks, the excess portion of the proximal flap was shaved and contoured to match the alar shape, and the patient recovered well with good nasal contour and preservation of facial subunit junctions. And please reference the article for more details on the repair and some helpful diagrams.
This is Erica Levitt reviewing the reconstructive conundrum, reconstruction of a defect on the right lower eyelid and infraorbital cheek by authors Remy Hamill and Isadora Tarantino. The defect is a 3 by 1.5 centimeter defect involving the lower eyelid and superior cheek. The authors chose to use a propeller flap to repair the defect. A propeller flap, also known as a flipped or rotated island pedicle flap, is an island flap that is axially rotated around a subcutaneous pedicle. The author's flap was designed laterally to the defect and rotated 180 degrees around a subcutaneous pedicle. This large angle of rotation was feasible due to the large vascular plexus. Before the flap was designed, the medial aspect of the defect was partially closed in order to decrease the size needed for the flap. The flap was undermined in the subcutaneous plane until the axis of rotation point, at which the pedicle was dissected to include muscle. The article has great images demonstrating the flap design and immediate post-op outcome. This was an interesting repair choice for this location that resulted in an excellent outcome with great tissue match and no eyelid tension.
This is Michael Renzi reviewing the reconstructive conundrum, reconstruction of nasal tip and right nasal sidewall defects by first author Margaret Coates and senior author Bradley Merritt. The authors describe the repair of a 1.6 centimeter defect on the nasal tip and a 1.3 centimeter defect on the right nasal sidewall following Mohs surgery for two basal cell carcinomas. For the nasal tip defect, they performed a superior extended V to Y advancement flap, which allowed recruitment of additional tissue from the nasal root and glabella. The flap was dissected toward the patient's right side because a previous surgery had been performed on the left side. Interestingly, with flap advancement, the pedicle fell immediately deep to the nasal sidewall defect, which stopped in the mid-subcutaneous tissue. For the sidewall defect, the authors opted to use a second V to Y advancement flap to efficiently draw on redundant tissue in the mulolabial fold and minimize additional tension on the aforementioned V to Y advancement flap. Outcome at 3 months can be seen in figure 4 of the article.
This is Deirdre Connolly reviewing the reconstructive conundrum, combination repair of nasal sidewall and supratip defect. First author Jose Cervantes, senior author Aiko Shimizu. A 79-year-old woman presented for Mohs surgery to treat two basal cell carcinomas involving the nasal tip and the right nasal sidewall. The final size of the defects were 1.6 and 1.3 centimeters, respectively. The authors constructed a superior extended V2Y advancement flap to recruit additional tissue from the nasal root and glabella. An inverted V-shaped incision was performed to the perichondrium medially and mid-subcutaneous tissue laterally. Bilevel undermining created a single sling of nasalis muscle, mobilizing the flap. To ensure a broad enough pedicle, the flap was extended into the glabellar skin. Interestingly, the flap pedicle fell immediately deep to the nasal sidewall defect, which stopped in the mid-subcutaneous tissue. Authors provided a short video clip demonstrating the flap's mobility and nasalis muscle pedicle that is worth viewing. The authors opted to use a second V2Y advancement flap to efficiently draw on redundant tissue in the melolabial fold and minimize additional tension on the aforementioned V2Y advancement flap for the nasal tip.
This is Christy Regulam reviewing the communication, How We Do It, V2Y advancement flap for the pixie ear deformity correction in patients with normal ear lobule size by first author Bakhtiar Najmuddin and senior author Tekin Kim. Pixie ear deformity is defined by a connected, tapered, and inferiorly based ear lobule. This may occur congenitally or as a result of a prior facelift. This commentary describes a simple surgical technique using a V2Y advancement flap for the correction of pixie ear deformity in a normal-sized earlobe. First, perioperative marking is performed with the patient in a seated position. Downward traction is applied to the earlobe and the crease is marked. The patient is then placed in a supine position, locally anesthetized, and the marked crease is incised with a 15 blade, extending posteriorly to the posterior sulcus. After undermining the earlobe, the lobe is fixed at the higher level to the SMAS using a 4-0 vicryl suture. Subcutaneous and epidermal suturing is then completed, with the defect on the lateral cheek being closed linearly.
This is Erica Levitt reviewing the communication, Predictors of Low Healthcare Literacy in Mohs Micrographic Surgery Patients by authors Robert Thiel and Ramona Bashad. The authors provide the background that a 2003 national assessment found that 36% of U.S. adults have basic or below basic healthcare literacy. The purpose of this study was to identify the prevalence of low healthcare literacy among Mohs surgery patients and which factors predict low health literacy among skin cancer patients. 92 patients over a one-month period at the author's clinic filled out a newest vital signs survey. This is an assessment tool that has been shown to be valid and reliable for screening for low healthcare literacy in primary care. Patients for this survey are presented with an ice cream nutrition label and are asked to answer 6 questions that require them to interpret text and do simple math. In this study, 30% of respondents were found to have low healthcare literacy using this survey tool. Increased age was significantly associated with lower healthcare literacy. In a multivariate model, only age was significantly associated. Interestingly, education level and rural versus urban living environments were not significantly associated with lower healthcare literacy. It would be interesting to see if these variables become significant in larger studies. This study addresses an important topic, as both the explanation of Mohs surgery itself and wound care instructions can be very complicated for patients with low healthcare literacy. Research identifying which patients are at risk for poor healthcare literacy, as well as techniques to enhance comprehension in this population, will allow us to provide the best patient care.
This is Michael Renzi reviewing the communication Optimal Preparation of Adipose Tissue in Frozen Sections for Mohs Micrographic Surgery by first author Thomas Huerta and senior author Joel Cook. The success of Mohs micrographic surgery relies on the surgeon's ability to accurately assess the complete peripheral and deep surgical margins. To achieve success, such tissue must be processed with care to minimize artifacts without cutting too deeply into the tissue block further away from the surgical margin. In this article, the authors describe their method of processing large adipose-rich specimens at an academic Mohs practice that has consistently produced high-quality sections. The temperature at which they embed, freeze, and section tissue is critical to yield artifact-free sections because incompletely frozen adipose tissue tears on sectioning. Such sections from tissue rich in adipose are best obtained at negative 28 degrees Celsius to negative 32 degrees Celsius. To mitigate the risk of ice crystal formation during freezing, which appears as holes in the adipose on completed sections, cryostats are set to negative 35 degrees Celsius, and Peltier plates, surfaces in which the cryostat chamber thermoelectrically cooled to negative 55 degrees Celsius, are used. These lower temperatures, careful selection of embedding medium, and attention to its reaction on tissue contact ensure continuity of the tissue block without separation of specimen from embedding medium. The histotechnologists are able to reliably cut large sections of adipose with minimal artifact at 6 to 8 micrometers within 15 to 30 minutes of receiving the tissue. I thought this article contained some valuable tips for tissue processing, and I recommend that the listeners review the step-by-step protocol for adipose processing available in the article.
This is Ashley Decker reviewing the Communication Surgeon's Knot with Three Throws to Facilitate Wound Closure, a video walkthrough by Drs. Woonenberg and Ozog. In this communication, the authors provide written narration of a supplemental video that shows how to perform a surgeon's knot with three throws. First, a buried vertical mattress suture is placed, followed by three throws to start the surgeon's knot, and it is cinched down by gently tugging back and forth parallel to the wound edges until there is eversion. While maintaining tension on the tail, that the needle driver is grasping, move the other end of the suture to the same side to seat your knot deep within the wound. Then, in a tension-free field, a second throw is completed to lock the knot. From there, an additional single throw, either squared or unsquared, can be performed for additional security. This technique is helpful for closing high-tension wounds. I invite the listeners to watch the video provided in the supplemental content online for further instruction.
This segment of the episode features general dermatologic surgery and cosmetic article reviews.
This is Michael Renzi reviewing the original investigation surgical matrixectomy versus phenolization in the treatment of ingrown toenails, a randomized controlled trial by first author Chandana Shajil and senior author Rashmi Kumari. Ingrowing of the nail, also called onychocryptosis, is a commonly seen painful condition affecting the toenails. The ingrown toenail, or IGN, treatment has evolved with innovative conservative methods, surgery, and combined treatment. Several surgical procedures include simple nail plate avulsion with the destruction of the nail matrix, and correction of the hypertrophic nail fold. In this study, the authors performed a randomized trial of 45 subjects to compare phenolization versus surgical matrixectomy after lateral nail plate avulsion in terms of efficacy, recurrence rates, postoperative outcomes, and cosmesis. Of the 45 patients, 43 completed the study, with 22 patients in the phenolization group and 21 in the surgical matrixectomy group, or SM group. In group 1, the authors did lateral nail plate avulsion followed by 80% to 88% phenol application to the matrix 3 times for 1 minute each round under local anesthesia, followed by dilution of phenol with 70% isopropyl alcohol. Group 2 received surgical matrixectomy, or SM, and I refer the listeners to the article for the details of this procedure. The authors then assessed these patients during their follow-up visits at 1 week, 1 month, and 6 months. The authors assessed pain at baseline and 1 week using visual analog scale scores. At 1 month, the authors recorded the time needed in days for pain relief, complete healing, resumption of daily activities, and postoperative complications, if any. At 6 months, the authors recorded the time taken in months for the nail to regain its normal morphology. Photographs taken at review were subjectively assessed by an unbiased blinded observer using a visual analog scale score. With 0 indicating poor to / unsatisfactory cosmetic outcome and a score of 10 indicating excellent cosmetic results. The number of days required for resuming activities, complete pain relief, and wound healing was slightly higher in group 2 than group 1, were the SM group compared to the phenolization group, though it was not statistically significant. The mean VAS showed significant improvement in group 1 at 1 week and 1 month, but not at 6 months. The time required to regain normal morphology was significantly longer in the surgical matrixectomy group at 2 months compared to just 1 month for the phenolization group. My takeaways from this article is that matrixectomy by phenolization is simple, effective, less invasive, and less painful with a shorter downtime, though it cannot be used in select patients such as those who are pregnant and those who are breastfeeding. Overall, both procedures are effective, and the patients and the treating physician can weigh the pros and cons of each when creating a treatment plan.
This is Christy Regula reviewing Clinical Anatomy of the Chin, evaluated by three-dimensional tomography and cadaveric dissection. Implications for safety and optimal injection techniques in Chinese by first author Sinru Li and senior author Sheng Kang Lao. The chin is a common area to perform soft tissue fillers to correct chin volume loss due to congenital conditions and aging. And this is an area that we typically think is a very safe area for hyaluronic acid injection. In recent years, however, several cases of unexpected complications from intravascular injections have been reported. This article discusses the anatomy of the lower third of the face based on cadaveric dissections and three-dimensional CT, and the author's experience with soft tissue fillers in the chin and mandible. Three-dimensional CTs were performed on 40 fresh frozen cadaveric heads with dye infused through the external carotid artery and internal carotid artery. The superficial and deep arteries from the lower lip vermilion border to the mentin were labeled. 20 of the cadavers were also dissected to define the layers of tissues. The paper details the courses of the mental artery, inferior labial artery, labial mental artery, submental artery, and ascending mental artery, and should be referenced for more details. They found that in the midline chin, there were many more superficial arteries than deep arteries. In addition, the number of arteries gradually decreased with the distance from the lower lip vermilion border increasing. Based on these observations, the authors suggested a simple technique for safe soft tissue filler injection of this area. The pogonion, which is the most anterior projection point, and the mentin, which is the most inferior projection point, serve as primary injection points with placement of filler directly above the periosteum. Please reference the article for more specific diagrams as well as photos of the cadaveric dissections.
This is Ardalan Minokete discussing aesthetic concerns of chin augmentations with hyaluronic acid soft tissue filler in Chinese, a prospective observational study. This is the same group who provided the previous article in our journal that looked at the anatomy of the chin. And they build upon that discussion of anatomy with a technique to safely augment the chin using 6 to 8 injection points. The details are described in the manuscript and nicely shown in figure 2. In the study, there were 23 Chinese women and 15 Chinese men who had congenital minimal to severe chin retrusion and ultimately retreated with Restylane Lift, a hyaluronic acid filler. All patients appeared to be very satisfied after the injection, and adverse events were minimal. Of note, the authors do point out that many scientific studies and references are really not relevant to the Chinese population promoting this study, but the Chinese aesthetic was not fully clear. Unless, however, we are led to assume that the satisfaction of the 38 individuals treated in this study does represent the Chinese ideal, then perhaps this injection technique does represent a more ideal treatment pattern for these individuals. Women are described as more ideal who have a more pointed chin with less alveolar prominences, and where projection is highlighted over the lack of overcorrection of chin shortening. And in men, a more prominent chin with 2 notable points is described as ideal. Of note, men were injected with an average of 2.68 cc's versus women who had 1.89 cc's on average. Additionally, the authors describe a very subjective analysis of chins from 2 plastic surgeons who looked at patients who were deemed beautiful, and also had a photo analysis of what was described as a publication of the 100 most beautiful and the 100 most handsome faces in China, where they did analyses in these patients and through photos to look at the ideal length of the chin. And it was shown that the ideal length of the chin was equal to that of the nasal dorsum in men. And the ideal chin to nasal dorsum ratio was 0.9 in female subjects. We do know that the chin is a very important facial structure, and chin deformities and abnormalities can directly affect facial attractiveness. This manuscript attempted to provide more evidence of the importance of the chin and overall facial aesthetics.
My name is Karan Lal, and I will be reviewing efficacy of platelet-rich plasma versus autologous fat transfer with nanofat in the treatment of infraorbital dark circles, a single-blinded randomized comparative clinical trial by authors Qadri et al. Out of Egypt. Periorbital dark circles are common in skin of color patients, and they are difficult to treat. Causes of dark circles include hyperpigmentation, skin laxity, and loss of subcutaneous fat. Treatment options include hyaluronic acid-based fillers, platelet-rich plasma, Q-Sitch lasers, and fat transfer. Platelet-rich plasma is thought to improve skin quality and discoloration. Fat grafting, on the other hand, combined with injection of nanofat, has been shown to improve not only a volume deficit but also improve skin quality. Nanofat is emulsified filtered fat which contains no fat cells but has abundant growth factors. In this study, 30 patients were randomized to receive either platelet-rich plasma or fat grafting with nanofat injections. Clinical improvement was evaluated by two blinded dermatologists at baseline compared to 6 months post-treatment. There were statistically significant differences in outcomes, with 7 patients having excellent response with autologous fat grafting versus 3 in the platelet-rich plasma cohort. More than half of patients in the platelet-rich plasma group had no improvement compared to only 1 patient in the fat grafting cohort. More importantly, 14 out of 15 patients were satisfied with their treatment after having completed autologous fat grafting with nanofat injection. Adverse events were mild in both groups and included bruising. While the study had a small sample size, only 1 comparative study on platelet-rich plasma for periorbital dark circles exists, making this treatment that is performed in the outpatient setting more anecdotal than scientific. Autologous fat transfer is superior to platelet-rich plasma in improving dark circles and has the advantage of having stem cells as well.
This is Monica Bowe, and I'll be reviewing Earlobe Rejuvenation, a review of current minimally invasive treatment modalities by Dr. Azawi and Dr. Agin. This was a comprehensive review of minimally invasive treatment options for earlobe rejuvenation. And the authors noted there is a paucity of literature on this subject. There is a good figure in the paper as a refresher on ear anatomy and vasculature. Just some points and tips from that figure. The vascular supply to the ear is derived from the external carotid artery by the superficial temporal artery and posterior auricular arteries. The review was split into topicals, chemical peels, lasers, and other injectables for the ear. The evidence for topical therapies is lacking for earlobe rejuvenation. There has been some studies using topical fluorouracil for earlobe rejuvenation and photodamage. However, there are mixed results for that. In terms of keloid excisions on the earlobe, the authors noted there were a few studies using topical imiquimod 5%, and it has been shown to decrease recurrence of keloids post-surgical removal. Chemical peels have also been used for earlobe rejuvenation. Commonly cited in the literature are Jesner's peels or Jesner's peels combined with TCA 20 to 35% have been used successfully for earlobe rejuvenation. Injectable hyaluronic acid fillers have also been used successfully for earlobe ptosis, and only small amounts are needed, sometimes 0.2 to 0.4 cc's. And the injection is into the subcutaneous planes. Ablative lasers have been reported in the literature for earlobe repair. And finally, the authors note that photodynamic therapy has been used for extensive photo damage on the ear successfully. So this is a good article and a summary of earlobe rejuvenation. Still, there is not that much literature on this one specific topic. However, this is a good comprehensive review if your patients come in with this aesthetic concern.
This is Yesil Kim, and I'll be reviewing a novel three-point injection technique for onobotulinum toxin A in the upper depressor anguli oris by first author Amir Marathi and senior author Jeanette Poehler. Downturned oral commissures are common with age, and the predominant muscle responsible is the depressor anguli oris, or DAO, which pulls the corner of the mouth inferiorly and laterally. Injection of the DAO with botulinum toxin mitigates this. However, injection in this area requires thorough knowledge of local anatomy, since the DAO overlies the depressor labia inferioris, and accidental injection or spread of the toxin into this muscle can result in asymmetric descent of the lower lip with potential drooling and slurred speech. The authors developed a three-point DAO injection technique that provides optimal aesthetic outcomes while avoiding common side effects. They aim to demonstrate the efficacy and safety of onobotulinum toxin A for treatment of the DAO in this prospective placebo-controlled trial. This study enrolled subjects 18 to 65 years of age. Injections were performed using a three-point technique in the upper DAO with 1.5 units per injection site. The first injection was just below and lateral to the oral commissure, where the skin dimples on activation of the DAO. The second injection was more laterally and at mid-distance from the oral commissure to the jawline along the line of the DAO. The third injection was between the first and second injection points along the same oblique line. The primary endpoint was a 1-grade improvement in the DAO contraction scale, and secondary endpoints included live evaluator rating and patient ratings of treatment effectiveness using the Global Aesthetic Improvement Scale. 10 subjects received onobotulinum toxin A and 10 received placebo saline injections. In the botulinum toxin treated subjects, DAO scores showed significant improvements at week 4 and 12 compared with baseline. There was no significant difference for placebo injected subjects. Global Aesthetic Improvement Scale scores showed that 100% of patients were improved compared with baseline at week 4 and 90% at week 12. Subject assessments matched the live evaluators at week 4, with 60% that continued to report improvement at week 12. No adverse events were reported. In conclusion, onobotulinum toxin A injections to the DAO using a three-point technique provides clinically meaningful improvements in the appearance of downturned oral commissures and softening the marinette lines. The authors note that they prefer this 3 injection of small unit doses to one higher unit dose to ensure that there's precise delivery of neurotoxin to the neuromuscular end plates and to limit spread to adjacent muscles. The treatment was noted to be well tolerated, and in most individuals it lasted at least 12 weeks.
This is Isabella Jones reviewing, Does Topical Anesthesia Alter the Outcomes of Vascular Laser Procedures? Review of Vasodynamic Effects and Clinical Outcome Data by Caitlin Glover and Vincent Richter. In this article, the authors performed a literature search on the vasodynamic effects of topical anesthesia and other topicals, specifically when it comes to their effect on vascular laser treatments. They first look at topical anesthetics and their effect on the skin vasculature. They found one main study examining this topic. In the study, 2.5% lidocaine and 2.5% prilocaine cream tended towards vasoconstriction, but in some other studies it was more vasodilatory. 4% tetracaine gel had no effect or slight vasodilation at 30 to 45 minutes. And 7% lidocaine with 7% tetracaine patch exhibited vasodilation at 30 minutes. The authors discuss that the effect on the vessel seems to be dependent on the anesthetic agent, concentration, and time. Therefore, there does not seem to be enough literature to be confident in how topical anesthetics affect the skin vasculature and whether they tend to be more vasodilatory or vasoconstrictive. Next, they looked at studies on other topical agents. A mouse model showed that PDL and topical oxymetazoline had a higher sustained vascular shutdown. but human studies have not been able to compare PDL with oxymetazoline versus PDL alone. Finally, they looked for studies examining the effect of topical anesthesia on the clinical efficacy of vascular laser treatment. They found only 3 studies looking at this topic, all using the pulse dye laser. Details of each study are described in the article, but 2 studies on port wine stains and 1 study on a range of vascular conditions like cherry angiomas and telangiectasias show that topical anesthesia overall caused less pain and did not seem to affect the clinical efficacy of the PDL treatment. The authors dive into an interesting discussion of how vasodilation or vasoconstriction may modify the efficacy of vascular lasers. In their literature review, the authors conclude there is currently insufficient evidence to advise against topical anesthetic use before light and laser-based vascular treatments.
This is Deirdre Hooper reviewing Skin Aging Exposome in Skin of Color Populations, a review of the literature by Rawan Mujari and Susan Taylor. This paper reviews the skin aging exposome, particularly in populations of skin of color. The authors began by reviewing the term exposome, which was first coined in the cancer and epidemiology literature to describe the totality of exposures to which an individual is subjected to from conception to death. In the introduction, the authors also review structural and biological differences that affect intrinsic aging in individuals with skin of color. The first and most important is increased melanin, which serves to protect from UV radiation, but conversely increases vulnerability of darkly pigmented skin to dyspigmentation. The second is that darker skin has numerous larger fibroblasts, smaller collagen fibers, and more macrophages than white skin, and it is postulated that this contributes to the preservation of skin elasticity and resistance to rhytid formation, but also to a greater propensity to scarring. In this review, the authors found 24 articles discussing aging and exposomes, particularly in skin of color. The first factor they looked at was solar radiation. Both immediate and persistent pigment darkening, as well as delayed tanning, are more pronounced in dark skin. And importantly, visible light has been shown to induce erythema and tanning in dark skin, but not in fair-skinned individuals. So sunscreens that protect against UV, but not visible light, do not fully prevent pigmentary disorders in dark skin. The second factor they looked at was air pollution, and this showed increased dyspigmentation and coarse wrinkling. Smoking was the third exposome factor and reviewed increase in rhytids, as well as 4 studies showing a significant correlation between smoking and premature graying of the hair. As far as nutrition, there was improved sun protection with dietary supplementation of vitamins E and C, carotenoids, and polyunsaturated fatty acid. Red meat and sugar increased rhytids. Scant literature exists about the effects of sleep, stress, and estrogen in general, and that literature is even rarer in skin of color populations. The limitation to this review was the variety of racial terms used in articles, making it difficult to find an all-inclusive review of the existing literature. The authors conclude by stating that as life expectancy increases, the comorbidities related to aging will require greater attention and research. Some exposome factors are preventable or can be modified. Others, including air pollution, will require more complex solutions.
This is Deirdre Connolly reviewing Motivations for Seeking Cosmetic Enhancing Procedures of the Face, a systematic review. First author Michael Martinez, senior author Evan Ryder. The authors note that current literature on motivations for seeking cosmetic procedures focus on psychopathologic motivations. In contrast, this review attempted to reveal the driving power of everyday intrapersonal, social, and behavioral factors that underlie interest in elective facial cosmetic procedures. The review included studies with at least 50 adult participants seeking cosmetic enhancements between the year 2000 and 2022. 21 studies with over 9,000 participants were selected for inclusion. 19 out of these 21 studies were solely cross-sectional. The review documents everyday factors as patient motivators for pursuing cosmetic enhancements of the face, with 17 out of these 21 studies including intrapersonal factors, such as dissatisfaction with facial features, broad body area, body fat, poor body image, anxiety about appearance, and low self-appraised attractiveness. Importantly, these factors appear consistent across patient race, gender, age, and country of origin. Key motivations for pursuing procedures of the face include wanting to look younger, look better in photographs, and rejuvenate one's appearance. 15 out of 21 studies included social factors in seeking cosmetic procedures. The most common motivators were the patient's social network and a desire to promote social standing. An analysis of university students indicated that participants are more likely to pursue facial cosmetic procedures if individuals in their social network have previously sought out a cosmetic procedure. 7 studies highlight that cosmetic patients often learn about cosmetic procedures from friends and colleagues. 4 of these studies implicate the role of teasing in cosmetic interest. In one study, approximately half of the patients seeking facial cosmetic enhancing procedures experienced teasing about their appearance. Less often, behavioral motivators have been studied, with 5 out of 21 studies addressing these factors. The behavioral factors are centered on social media and media consumption as impacting patient motivation for cosmetic enhancements. In the only experimental study captured by the review, researchers showed that participants who viewed the cosmetic surgery television show were more interested in pursuing cosmetic procedures than those who viewed a neutral media show, which suggested that the consumption of media featuring cosmetics could potentially increase viewers' interest in elective cosmetics. Other studies showed that greater consumption of social media, for example, TikTok, correlated with more interest in cosmetic procedures, and that the manipulation and editing of photographs on social media appears to be a key social media behavior predictive of cosmetic surgery interest. Overall, the review demonstrates, as one would expect, that patient motivations for facial cosmetic enhancements may be well understood through everyday interpersonal, social, and behavioral factors.
This is Monica Bowen, and I'll be reviewing a retrospective study of the temporal artery biopsies performed in the dermatology department of Alicante University Hospital from Spain from 2010 to 2020 by authors Dr. Cabanas and last author Dr. Martinez. So giant cell arteritis is a form of vasculitis that causes inflammation of the blood vessels, most commonly, as we learned in medical school, the temporal artery. And it usually occurs in older patients over 50 and requires prompt treatment with corticosteroids. Temporal artery biopsy is the gold standard for diagnosis with an 85% sensitivity and 100% sensitivity specificity. The authors did a retrospective study on 73 patients who underwent temporal artery biopsy, and they noted no complications were reported. 49% had a positive result, and Doppler ultrasounds were highly correlated with biopsy results as well. The gist of this article is that the authors conclude that dermatologists are able to perform this simple procedure to diagnose giant cell arteritis and that complications are rare, and this is something that you can incorporate into your practice.
This is Ardalan Minocchetti describing the manuscript, How We Do It, the longitudinal nail strip biopsy for nail unit inflammatory dermatoses from the dermatologist at the University of Pennsylvania. Many dermatologists are resistant and hesitant to do a nail biopsy. Previous techniques like the gold standard lateral longitudinal excision, which is a variation of the fusiform biopsy that samples all anatomic areas of the nail unit, come with risks of scarring, acquired malalignment, and development of lateral spicules. The technique described, this longitudinal nail strip biopsy from Adam Rubin and his group, is easier to perform and less invasive, and as shown in figure 1, provides an approximately 2 millimeter wide strip of the nail unit made by joining 2 longitudinal incisions starting at the distal end of the nail matrix and extending to the hyponychium. It's then elevated with forceps, as shown in figure 2, and then the deep aspect of the specimen is removed along the plane of the distal phalanx using gradle scissors in a tips down position or with a scalpel. And to note, keeping the excision limited to that distal matrix at the proximal aspect of the excised tissue really helps limit postoperative dystrophy. It samples multiple key areas. The pathologist should know to perform longitudinal sectioning. And another benefit not described by those who propose similar techniques is the utility in inflammatory disorders, as it really samples a wide range of nail unit anatomy and provides for easier patient recovery.
My name is Karan Lal, and I will be reviewing treatment of palmar hyperhidrosis with radiofrequency microneedling by Dr. Kim from South Korea. Radiofrequency microneedling has been shown to be successful in the treatment of axillary hyperhidrosis. In fact, I currently do this procedure, and it is extremely successful, with some patients getting greater than 50% improvement in reduction in sweating after one treatment. However, it has not been studied on the palms or on the soles. Its use on the palms and soles has not been well studied, given pain and difficulty engaging needle depth. In this case, a 35-year-old was treated with the Lutronic Infinity device every 4 weeks for four sessions with a needle depth of 1.5 and 2 millimeters and a 500 millisecond pulse duration. You can see the before and after starch iodine test in figure 1. There was no relapse or compensatory hyperhidrosis during 6 months follow-up. Radiofrequency microneedling causes permanent injury to sweat glands, which is not reversible. While the treatment was considered painless, I would be concerned for pain and temporary sensory neuropathy following treatment. In addition, I'd be concerned about potential muscle weakness, which can occur even after botulinum toxin treatment. This may be an evolving great treatment for patients. However, it probably and might be more painful than we imagine. And the benefits include there is not only no relapse, but there has not been reports of compensatory hyperhidrosis elsewhere.
Welcome to Beyond the Digest, offering bonus content covering surgical articles in dermatologic literature outside the peer-reviewed journal Dermatologic Surgery. Reference the episode description for publication details of the content covered.
My name is Amy Green, and I will be reviewing the research letter entitled No Difference in Survival for Primary Cutaneous Pleomorphic Sarcoma After Mohs Surgery and Wide Local Excision by Dr. Moore and senior author Dr. Emily Ruiz out of Brigham and Women's Hospital. Cutaneous pleomorphic sarcoma has been historically referred to by several names in the literature, including malignant fibrous histiocytoma and undifferentiated pleomorphic sarcoma, but is thought to be a rare cutaneous sarcoma treated with local resection. The literature demonstrates a wide 5-year survival range of 48 to 77%, but there is limited survival data for localized primary cutaneous pleomorphic sarcoma treated with Mohs surgery compared to wide local excision. So for this study, cases were extracted from the SEER registry using the International Classification of Disease for Oncology code 8830-3, which codes for malignant fibrous histiocytoma. Patients with localized primary tumors were included and analyzed by surgical approach, where wide local excision was defined as cases with known margins of greater than or equal to 1 centimeter, and those with pathologically negative margins. Non-cutaneous tumors and metastases were excluded. Patient and tumor characteristics are highlighted in Table 1, so I'll turn you to that. 484 primary cutaneous pleomorphic sarcomas were included. The majority were in white males, and a greater proportion of wide local excision were located on the trunk compared with those treated with Mohs surgery. 8.9% of cutaneous pleomorphic sarcomas treated with Mohs surgery and 8.7% of the tumors treated with wide local excision underwent adjuvant chemo and radiation. The 5-year survival was similar between both groups at 66.1%. There was no statistically significant difference in overall or disease-specific survival for wide local excision compared to Mohs surgery, which can be seen in Table 2.
A secondary analysis comparing Mohs surgery to patients undergoing excision with no reported margins or margin status demonstrated or unknown margin status demonstrated similar findings of no difference in overall survival or disease-specific survival. Further studies would need to be done looking at the effects of surgical modality on local regional recurrence. Although outside of the scope of the study, the five-year survival of 66.1% illustrates the need for further studies on this malignancy and correct classification of these tumors.
My name is Amy Green, and I will be reviewing the research letter entitled Yield of Sentinel Lymph Node Biopsy in Sebaceous Carcinoma and Predictors of Advanced Disease, a retrospective analysis of the National Cancer Database by Dr. Maloney and senior author Dr. Zaba. Sebaceous carcinoma is a rare malignancy with a potential for lymph node or distant metastases. Sentinel node positivity of up to 16% has been demonstrated in one cohort, leading to the present guidelines suggesting consideration of sentinel lymph node biopsies in periocular tumors T2C or greater. So this means a tumor that is 10 to 20 millimeters in greatest dimension involving full thickness eyelid. Sentinel lymph node biopsy positivity appears to be much lower in extraocular sebaceous carcinoma and is currently not recommended. The yield of sentinel lymph node biopsy still remains to be determined, so this study looked at the National Cancer Database to investigate utilization and yield of sentinel lymph node biopsy in sebaceous carcinoma, as well as factors associated with advanced disease. Complete methods are available in the supplemental materials. The cohort comprised of around 1,400 patients, and 5% had advanced disease in the form of nodal or distant metastases, and 95% had localized disease. Patients' demographics and tumor characteristics can be seen in Table 1. Factors associated with advanced disease included periocular primary site, high-grade histology, tumor size greater than 2 centimeters, and Medicaid or patients with no insurance. And a multivariate logistic regression analysis demonstrated each of those factors to be independent predictors of advanced disease, and this can be seen in Table 2. Sentinel lymph node biopsy was performed in 10.7% of cases, and 7.4% of those were positive. Sentinel lymph node biopsy was negative in 4 cases with advanced disease, so the false negativity rate was 26.7%. Factors associated with increased use of sentinel lymph node biopsy included a younger patient, primary site on trunk and extremities, and private insurance. Sentinel lymph node biopsy positivity rate was only slightly lower for extraocular sebaceous carcinoma, and of the positive sentinel lymph node biopsy patients, 2/3 had a high histologic grade. This study found that high histologic grade and tumors greater than 2 centimeters are useful predictors of advanced disease, and given that half the patients with advanced disease had extraocular tumors, sentinel lymph node biopsies should be considered in these situations. The utility of sentinel lymph node biopsy still needs to be further explored, as this study showed a significant false negative rate, especially in the head and neck region, and the predictors of sentinel lymph node biopsy and the prognostic impact could not be explored. Additional limitations include inability to incorporate the AJCC8 staging, which was only available in the National Cancer Database in 2018.
My name is Amy Green, and I will be reviewing the original investigation entitled External Validation of the Skin and UV Neoplasia Transplant Risk Assessment Calculator, or SUNTRAC, in a Large European Solid Organ Transplant Recipient Cohort by Dr. Alvaro Gomez Tomas and senior author Dr. Carla Ferrandiz Pulido. The SUNTRAC tool was developed to risk stratify transplant patients with respect to cutaneous malignancies in order to provide guidelines on when they should be screened post-transplant. This tool was proposed in 2019 and considered 5 factors which have been identified as risk factors in a large U.S.-based multicenter study, and these include sex, race, age at transplantation, pre-transplant history of skin cancer, and type of transplant. Patients are classified in 4 risk groups: low risk, medium risk, high risk, and very high risk, and optimal screening times are recommended based on those groups.
Although it achieved good prognostic discrimination in the transplant skin cancer network population, which was studied, to the author's knowledge, there have been no validation studies in independent population samples. So this study is a retrospective external validation prognostic study using data from prospectively collected cohort of European solid organ transplant recipients from teaching hospitals in the Netherlands and Spain. These two populations had well-known differences in skin cancer incidence. The Dutch cohort comprised patients with kidney or pancreas transplant between 1995 and 2016, and the Spanish cohort comprised patients who received lung, kidney, liver, heart, or pancreas between 2011 and 2021. Race and ethnicity were categorized as Asian, Black, Latino, Middle Eastern, and North American, or white. First skin cancer event after transplant diagnosis was based on histopathologic diagnosis of a cutaneous squamous cell carcinoma, basal cell carcinoma, Merkel cell carcinoma, or melanoma. Patients were considered to have a pre-transplant history if they had a registered diagnosis of either of these tumors. Pediatric patients were omitted. For quick reference, the derivation cohort used to generate SunTract was comprised of about 6,300 patients. The majority of them were male. 70% were white race with a median age of 53. About half of them had received a kidney transplant. The skin cancer outcome included first squamous cell carcinoma, melanoma, and Merkel cell, but did not consider basal cell as an outcome. So this specific study focused on assessing the discrimination power of the tool, but also assess calibration by comparing cumulative incidence functions and comparing five-year cumulative incidence of skin cancer in their specific cohort with those reported in the derivation cohort. I will direct you to the methods section for the detailed statistical analyses used. So about 3,400 patients were included with a median age of transplant of 53, with 17.6 developing skin cancer, with a median follow-up time of about 6 years. 83% of the patients were white, and complete demographic information can be seen in Table 1. Cumulative incidence of skin cancer was 2.1% at 1 year and 12.1% at 5 years. Patients developing skin cancer were more likely men, 50 years or older, white with a history of pre-transplant skin cancer, higher SunTract total scores, and belonging to higher SunTract risk groups. All SunTract variables except type of transplant were statistically significant risk factors associated with developing skin cancer, which can be seen in Table 3. White race and previous history of skin cancer were the most relevant. Additionally, in this cohort, an age cutoff of 53 from the survival tree model or 52 via a maximally selected REN statistic method was the most discriminating age cut point. SunTrack scores were verified to be associated with an increased risk of skin cancer with a 1-point increase associated with 25% increase in skin cancer. The 4-tier classification system was also found to yield the best prognostic discrimination as in the original cohort. The optimal cut points in the validation cohort aligned very closely with the original SunTrack tool. Figure 1 displays the cumulative incidence of skin cancer by SunTrack group, with the higher risk groups showing higher skin cancer incidence as at all times. Figure 2 shows the cumulative incidence and 5-year skin cancer cumulative incidence after transplant between the validation cohort and the original cohorts. And authors found similar predicted skin cancer incidence with a lower percent in the original cohort after 5 years or 5 years after transplant. So the limitations of this study are outlined and includes its retrospective nature, differences in immunosuppressive regimen, and incompleteness of cancer registration. But overall, the findings of the study support this the use of this tool in the European populations for stratifying solid organ transplant recipients based on skin cancer risk, which may help optimize skin cancer screening intervals and follow-up for these patients.
My name is Yessel Kim, and I'll be reviewing follow-up of patients with keratinocyte carcinoma, a systematic review of clinical practice guidelines by first author Sarah Morali and senior author Anwen Chan in JAMA Dermatology. Follow-up after treatment of keratinocyte carcinomas aims to detect recurrence and metastases of the treated tumor, monitor for occurrence of new tumors, and encourage sustained prevention behavior. However, it is unclear how often patients should be seen for follow-up skin exams. Therefore, the authors performed a systematic review to summarize the recommendations, identify variations and evidence gaps, and evaluate the quality of clinical practice guidelines for dermatologic follow-up of patients with basal cell carcinomas and squamous cell carcinomas. The authors searched for guidelines addressing the management of BCCs or SCCs. They included the guideline if it met the following criteria. Reported a guideline defined as clinical recommendations intended to optimize patient care that were developed through a defined process evaluating evidence from literature or expert consensus. Provided recommendations for follow-up frequency after diagnosis of localized BCC or SCC in immunocompetent patients of any age and sex. Was developed by national or international organizations and was published in English or French from 2010 to 2022. The authors were primarily interested in recommendations about the frequency and total duration of follow-up skin exams, including any risk factors considered. In total, 14 studies met eligibility criteria. Half of them provided recommendations for basal cell carcinomas only, 6 addressed SCCs only, and 1 addressed both. Most of the guidelines stratify their follow-up recommendations by the tumor's risk of recurrence or metastases. Among the 8 guidelines that address basal cell carcinomas, 3 did not stratify their recommendations by recurrence risk. 2 suggested annual follow-up, while 1 recommended follow-up every 6 to 12 months for the first 5 years and then annual visits. The remaining 5 guidelines stratified their follow-up exam recommendations by risk group. For low-risk basal cell carcinomas, follow-up recommendations range from every 6 to 12 months. For high-risk basal cell carcinomas, 1 guideline suggested follow-up every 3 months, while 4 recommended every 6 months. For low-risk squamous cell carcinomas, 5 guidelines recommended annual follow-up, 3 guidelines every 6 months, and 1 guideline every 3 months. For high-risk squamous cell carcinomas, recommendations varied from every 3 months, 4 months, or 6 months, or annually. The findings of this systematic review highlight the variations in follow-up recommendations for patients after initial treatment for keratinocyte carcinomas. My name is Yesil Kim, and I'll be reviewing the research letter, Sociodemographic Factors Associated with Mohs Micrographic Surgery versus Why Local Excision in Pediatric Dermatofibrosarcoma Protuberans by first author Jessica Brown Corsall and senior author Jeremy Bordeaux in February's JAD. Dermatofibrosarcoma protuberans, or DFSP, is a rare, locally aggressive soft tissue sarcoma that is also very rare in children. Racial and ethnic differences in the utilization of Mohs among adults with DFSP exist. This has not been yet reported in pediatric patients with DFSP. So these authors aim to investigate the factors associated with the utilization of Mohs versus Y local excision among pediatric patients with DFSP using the SEER database and the National Cancer Database. 144 and 233 pediatric patients met the inclusion criteria from each database. White children with DFSP were more likely to receive Mohs than Black children in both the SEER and National Cancer Databases. Patients with Medicaid, Medicare, or other forms of government insurance were less likely to receive Mohs. Hispanic children were less likely to receive Mohs compared with non-Hispanic children. And although Mohs for DFSP is associated with lower rates of recurrence, Mohs was underutilized within the SEER database, 18%, and National Cancer Database, 27.9%, compared with Y local excision among pediatric patients. Furthermore, the study revealed racial and ethnic differences in the utilization of Mohs versus Y local excision. White children were more likely to receive Mohs compared with Black children, and Hispanic children were 85% less likely to receive Mohs compared with non-Hispanic children. In addition, the care of the pediatric patients with DFSP may be dictated by insurance status and that those with government insurance were 67% less likely to receive Mohs. This study shows the underutilization of Mohs for DFSP and that it was associated with insurance status, race, and ethnicity. More research and initiatives are needed to address the barriers to Mohs for Black and Hispanic children and those with government insurance.
This is Gima Tosco, and I will be discussing prognostic role of microsatellites in melanoma and implications in the American Joint Committee on Cancer Classification System, a cohort study by first author Constanza Laughlin and senior author Sebastian Poplipnik out of Barcelona. In this retrospective bicenter cohort study, authors sought to evaluate survival outcomes in patients with microsatellites, assess their role within stage 3 stratification of AJCC classification, and assess the results of central lymph node biopsies in patients with microsatellites. Of the 5,216 patients identified, 108 had microsatellites at initial staging of primary invasive melanoma. Compared to the control group, the group with microsatellites were more likely to be older, male, with more advanced tumor stage, with tumors on the head, neck, and acral locations, and with evidence of metastasis. The presence of microsatellites remains significantly associated with worse overall survival, melanoma-specific survival, and disease-free survival. Using both the 7th and 8th AJCC additions, the 5-year survival was worse in patients with stage 3B melanoma with microsatellites compared to those without. Similarly, melanoma-specific survival was worse in patients with stage 3B melanoma with microsatellites in the 8th edition of the AJCC. The best survival outcomes were seen in patients with no microsatellites and a negative central lymph node biopsy, followed by no microsatellites and a positive central lymph node biopsy, with the worst survival in patients with microsatellites and a positive central lymph node biopsy. The study showed microsatellites to be an independent risk factor for overall survival, melanoma-specific survival, and disease-free survival. Patients with stage 3B melanoma with microsatellites have worse overall survival and melanoma-specific survival, whereas patients with stage 3C melanoma had worse overall survival, but not melanoma-specific survival. This is Kim Matosko, and I will be discussing primary cutaneous melanoma features predict development of in-transit metastases and satellite lesions, Mayo Clinic Experience 2010 to 2014, by first author Anagha Kumar and senior author Christian Baum. In this retrospective single-center case-control study, authors sought to identify microscopic features associated with subsequent development of in-transit metastases and satellite lesions. Reviewing records of patients between 2010 and 2014, authors identified 26 patients who were at least 18 years old at the time of primary cutaneous melanoma and later developed in-transit metastases and satellite lesions without synchronous stage 4 disease. Controls were matched 3-to-1 for age and median follow-up period. Age, anatomic location of primary cutaneous melanoma, melanoma subtype, Breslow depth, ulceration, angiolymphatic invasion, number of mitoses, and development of in-transit metastases and satellite lesions were analyzed. Univariate analysis showed nodular subtype, ulceration, Breslow depth greater than 1, and greater than 1 mitoses per millimeter squared to be associated with future development of in-transit metastases and satellite lesions. Using multivariate model, only Breslow depth was statistically significant. This study adds to the growing body of knowledge around the importance of in-transit metastases and satellite lesions in patients with primary cutaneous melanoma. This is Kim Matosko reviewing sentinel lymph node biopsy in Merkel cell carcinoma, rates and predictors of compliance with the National Comprehensive Cancer Network guidelines by first author Daniel Lewis and last author William Higgins of the University of Pennsylvania. NCCN guidelines recommend sentinel lymph node biopsy in all patients with Merkel cell carcinoma without clinical nodal disease or known metastasis. To identify compliance with this guideline, authors queried the National Cancer Database for cases of Merkel cell carcinoma with reported surgical treatment type and sentinel lymph node biopsy status. Patients with clinical stage 3 or 4 and in situ Merkel cell carcinoma were excluded. Sentinel lymph node biopsy was performed in 1,530 of the 2,901 included patients with Merkel cell carcinoma, with the rate of compliance increasing from 47.6% in 2012 to 54.5% in 2017. Sentinel lymph node biopsy was more likely with treatment at academic centers, conventional excision, private insurance, age less than 65 years, and tumors on the trunk and extremities. Overall compliance with NCCN guidelines is low, but this study shows that it is increasing and directs attention to certain variables that are more likely to be associated with noncompliance.
Hello, this is Harrison Nguyen reviewing the article Limitations in the Literature Regarding Mohs Surgery and Stage Excision for Melanoma, a critical review of quality and data reporting by first authors Jonas Adelsteinsen and Victoria Stodge and senior author Desiree Ratner. In recent years, there has been a growing body of literature supporting the utilization of Mohs micrographic surgery and stage excision with rush permanent section for the treatment of melanoma. Several studies have shown diminished recurrence rates of melanoma using these two methods compared to wide local excision. In this study, the authors performed a literature review and critiqued the literature using a framework called the Risk of Bias in Non-Randomized Studies of Interventions, or Robin's Eye Criteria. The Robin's Eye Criteria is designed to measure bias in 7 categories. Using the Robin's Eye Criteria, the authors report serious or critical bias in 47 out of 48 studies. Specifically, they highlighted that the literature is comprised primarily of cohort studies and case series, and the defined outcome of local recurrence was inconsistent across studies. The authors conclude that randomized control trials are needed and that a singular definition for local recurrence should be defined and be used consistently. In my opinion, I agree with these conclusions, but I think it is also important to take into context the biases that the study highlights. First, these biases exist for the studies on wide local excision as well for the treatment of melanoma. In fact, there has been no consensus for local recurrence across the melanoma and non-melanoma skin cancer literature. I'd also like to remind listeners that the data supporting Mohs surgery in general, including for the treatment of basal cell carcinoma and squamous cell carcinoma, is not based on randomized control trials, but rather on cohort studies and case series. This, for better or worse, forms the foundation of our field in cutaneous oncologic surgery. So this all must be interpreted within this context. And in my opinion, the study by Adelson et al. Should not be used as an argument against Mohs and stage excision for the treatment of melanoma. Hello, this is Harrison Nguyen reviewing a commentary which was written in response to the JAD article, Limitations in the Literature Regarding Mohs Surgery and Stage Excision for Melanoma, a critical review of quality and data reporting. This commentary was written by first author Christopher Miller and senior author Rajiv Najawan. In this short article, the authors, who come from several of the institutions that have published the data on Mohs surgery and stage excision for melanoma, respond to the study that was published by Adelson et al. As a reminder, Adelson's study performed a literature review showing bias existing in 47 out of 48 studies on Mohs surgery and stage excision for melanoma and concluded that improved reporting and prospective data are necessary. Miller et al. Start by agreeing that a uniform definition for local recurrence, surgical technique description, reliable follow-up, and defining relevant tumor characteristics are necessary for all studies, but then go on to bring up two counterpoints to Adelson's et al.'s paper. First, they highlight that Adelson's group did not highlight that similar biases, especially the inconsistencies in defining local recurrence, exist in the publications surrounding wide local excision. Secondly, Miller and colleagues argue that Adelson's data do not explain how the different biases may influence low recurrence rates after Mohs or stage excision. For example, in one of the studies that Chris Miller led in the past, phone calls were used to assess for recurrence for some patients, which was a source of bias that Adelson's paper draws attention to. Miller and colleagues, however, argue that if one were to remove those patients who had telephone follow-up, the recurrence rate would actually be even lower. Overall, while Miller and colleagues agree with the importance of improved definitions and need for prospective studies, they remind the readers that context matters and that these biases apply not just to Mohs and stage excisions, but also to wide local excisions for treatment of melanoma.
This is Elizabeth Cusick reviewing the article, Risk Factors Associated with First and Second Primary Melanomas in a High Incidence Population by senior author Dr. David Whiteman. This article begins by providing the background that increasing melanoma incidence and declining mortality leads to an increasing number of patients with melanoma that are surviving to be at risk of developing second and subsequent melanomas, thereby highlighting the importance of understanding the risk factor profile of patients in order to more appropriately target prevention efforts. Prior to this current study, there were no population-based prospective cohort studies with disease-free controls that have reported on risk factors for developing first versus second primary melanomas. In essence, authors sought to answer the basic question, do second melanomas develop in people who have a risk factor profile different from that of people who develop only one melanoma during a defined period of follow-up? The objective of this study is to compare the clinical characteristics of first and second melanomas, and then to estimate the relative risks of developing one versus multiple melanomas associated with self-reported demographic, phenotypic, sun exposure, and genetic factors. This prospective, long-term, and large-scale population-based cohort study involving the Q Skin Sun and Health Study included adults aged 40 to 69 years old from 2011 to 2018 in Queensland, Australia. A total of 38,845 patients were included during a median follow-up period of 7.4 years. 3.1% of participants had a single primary melanoma diagnosis, while 0.6% had a second primary diagnosis. Second melanomas were more likely than first melanomas to be in situ or thinner invasive melanomas, suggesting that there's greater surveillance following a primary diagnosis of melanoma. Having many moles at age 21 years, which were self-reported in this study, a high genetic predisposition and history of multiple skin cancer excisions were all more likely strongly associated with a second melanoma. There was limited evidence that supported the fact that higher levels of personal sun exposure were associated with multiplicity. For all other phenotypic characteristics and sun exposure measures, similarly elevated associations were observed. Findings suggest that people who develop second and primary melanomas have more nevi, greater genetic risk than people who develop only one melanoma. This study highlights the need for more continued robust research on preventing and detecting second and subsequent melanomas in the future.
This is Elizabeth Cusick reviewing the research letter, Clinical and Prognostic Influence of Tumor Diameter in Acral Lentiginous Melanoma, by senior author Wu Chin Lee and first author Myung Chow. This article begins by providing the background that while tumor diameter is an important prognostic factor in non-melanoma skin cancer and uveal melanoma, the prognostic implications of tumor diameter on acral lentiginous melanoma is largely unknown. Utilizing a database research, authors investigated the importance of acral lentiginous melanoma tumor size in terms of clinical features and prognosis. This was a retrospective study of 126 patients with non-nail unit acral melanoma and 88 patients with nail apparatus melanoma, using available data on tumor size diagnosed between 1998 and 2020 at a single center. Authors observed that long tumor diameter was a cutoff value of 13 millimeters, and it had statistically significantly worse survival in terms of progression-free survival, deeper Breslow depth, ulceration, and subcutaneous extension, as well as lymph node positivity and metastasis. Survival outcomes did not vary significantly by the mean tumor diameter within similar tumor stage subgroups. Although a correlation between tumor diameter and poor prognostic clinical pathologic variables was observed, the prognostic value of Breslow thickness remains the most important indicator. In summary, the results of this retrospective study suggest that tumor diameter with a cutoff value of 13 millimeters along with Breslow depth is an independent prognostic factor for acral melanomas, highlighting the need for continued robust research on these tumors.
Thank you for listening to Derm Surgery Digest, the official podcast of the Dermatologic Surgery Journal. To access these featured articles, author videos, and much more, visit journals.lww.com/dermatologicsurgery. To learn more about the American Society for Dermatologic Surgery, visit asds.net.
This is Ashley Decker reviewing the original investigation, improved margin control of microcystic adnexal carcinoma following Mohs micrographic surgery compared to wide local excision by Sharmitha Yurnini and Emily Ruiz. In this original investigation, the authors compared the surgical outcomes for Mohs versus wide local excision in the treatment of microcystic adnexal carcinoma, or MAC. MAC is a rare cutaneous neoplasm often found in the head and neck regions with a deeply infiltrative growth pattern, potentially leading to significant morbidity. Surgery has always been the gold standard for treatment of MAC. However, there has never been a head-to-head comparison between Mohs and wide local excision. 69 patients with biopsy-proven MACs who had undergone either a wide local excision or Mohs at a single institution between 1994 and 2021 were included. Demographic and outcome information was recorded. 34 patients were treated with Mohs and 35 with wide local excision. There was no difference in age, immune status, or history of skin cancer. 21 patients, or 60% of primary MACs treated with wide local excision, had positive margins after the initial surgery necessitating further resection, whereas all tumors treated with Mohs achieved negative surgical margins on the first attempt. The average number of Mohs stages was 1.8. Local recurrences, nodal disease, and distant metastasis was rare in the entire cohort, but local recurrence was more common in the wide local excision group. Out of the 21 tumors with positive margins after initial excision, 4 tumors never achieved negative histologic margins. This is the largest study to directly compare the surgical outcomes of primary MAC tumors treated with Mohs versus wide local excision. Over half of the wide local excision cohort had positive histological margins after the initial resection, whereas all of the tumors treated with Mohs had negative margins on the first surgical attempt. MACs have a deeply infiltrative growth pattern, and the benefit of Mohs is it allows for complete deep and peripheral margin assessment in real time. As the authors point out, peripheral and deep ONFOS margin assessment is recommended by the NCCN for other cutaneous tumors with infiltrative growth patterns similar to MACs. This article really highlights the importance of utilizing Mohs when treating these rare and aggressive tumors, and I commend the authors for getting more data out there in our literature to support the use of Mohs. This is Ashley Decker reviewing the reconstructive conundrum, repair of a large central facial defect involving the nasal dorsum, nasal sidewall, medial canthus, and glabella by Drs. Passy and Merritt. A 97-year-old woman underwent Mohs surgery for a 2.8-centimeter basal cell on the nasal root. Clear margins were obtained in 5 levels, and the final defect measured 4.5 centimeters involving the left nasal sidewall, nasal dorsum, glabella, and left medial canthus with extension into the cranial periosteum and nasal cartilage. This large central face defect is very complicated for several reasons, including cosmetic implications, involvement of numerous cosmetic subunits, and concern for functionality of the underlying musculature. Due to the size of the defect, the list of potential closure options was limited and included a full-thickness skin graft with an additional hinge flap to cover the wound bed, double transposition or rotation flaps, or a perimedian forehead flap. To simplify things, the authors divided the defect into distinct subunits, including the nasal dorsum slash sidewall, and then the medial canthus and glabellar area, and designed a multi-component single-stage repair. For the lower segment on the nasal sidewall, a peri-alar crescenteric advancement flap was used to repair the medial canthus glabella nasal root portion of the defect. A flipped island pedicle flap based on the supratrochlear artery was designed. The supratrochlear artery was identified via Doppler and a template made of the residual defect. Parallel incisions were made to the periosteum of the forehead and extended inferior to the brow, where a 1.2 centimeter pedicle was preserved, very similar to a standard perimedian forehead flap. The flap was elevated in the subcutaneous plane until mid-forehead and then submuscular from there on to protect the supratrochlear artery. The flap was rotated 90 degrees and sutured into place using suspension from the medial canthal tendon, followed by a layered closure. I recommend the listeners to look at the photographs in this article. Visualization of this unique repair is helpful. The patient overall had a great cosmetic outcome. The article is a good reminder that when you have a large defect involving multiple subunits, on initial glance, it can feel very overwhelming, but breaking down the defect into subunits is helpful to simplify things in your mind and come up with the best repair possible.
This is Monica Bowen, and I'll be reviewing collagenase clostridium histolyticum injections for volumetric change of cellulite dimples and gluteal contouring by first author Nina Hartman and last author Sabrina Fabi. cellulite has an almost 80 to 98% prevalence in postpubertal women that may be due to altercations in the dermal subcutaneous interface, fat globules, and fibrous septae. Collagenase Clostridium histolyticum is composed of two purified collagenases that hydrolyze type 1 and 3 collagen and was FDA approved for this indication in 2020. It is an outpatient injection that is relatively quick into the cellulite dimples, but side effects are prolonged and rather severe bruising throughout the treatment area, possible pain post-injection, and possible nodules. This study was a retrospective review to assess the volumetric change in individual cellulite dimples on the buttocks and enhancement of overall gluteal contour after collagenase injections using Canfield 3D imaging and a 7-point physician global improvement scale at day 90 and 180 after treatment. A total of 58 female subjects, and these were from cohort 2 of a previous collagenase study, were included in the retrospective image review. Canfield 3D imaging showed a significant improvement in total negative dimple volume of 27% at day 90, and this was maintained at 26% at day 180. So in this retrospective image review, overall gluteal contour was observed to be improved in 20% of patients at day 90 and 26% at day 180. However, about 16% of patients did note a worsening gluteal contour, perhaps due to underlying skin laxity. And 48% did not have any improvement in gluteal contour. This study helps to better understand the effects of cellulite dimples and gluteal contour when treating the fibrous septae, and perhaps when treating the fibrous septae with collagenase or the treatments, this can give an overall improved gluteal contour in some patients. Of note, collagenase Clostridium histolyticum is no longer on the market due to the resultant purpura and then post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation post-treatment. This is Monica Bowen, and I'll be reviewing the commentary on the article Collagenase Clostridium histolyticum Injections for Volumetric Change of Cellulite Dimples and Gluteal Contouring by Sachin Sridharani. The author notes that it is interesting that 12 patients had actually a negative gluteal contour post collagenase Clostridium histolyticum injections, and 48% had no improvement. Thus, it is important to counsel patients that after treatment of the cellulite dimples with collagenase, they may have a decreased overall buttocks volume or no change at all in the gluteal contour. Overall, the author applauds the study as it shows that collagenase Clostridium histolyticum yields improvement in dimple severity and gluteal volume changes that is sustained over 180 days. However, I do want to note that this product is no longer on the market due to the bruising and purpura post-treatment and resulting post-inflammatory hyperpigmentation. This is Monica Bowen, and I'll be reviewing treatment patterns of port wine birthmark with pulse dye laser among dermatology practices in the United States by first author Vijay Kodamundi and last author Hua Feng. The authors wanted to investigate patterns among dermatologists nationwide that use pulse dye laser to treat port wine birthmarks. Earlier treatment of port wine birthmarks, even as early as 2 weeks, leads to better results. The authors used the physician finder from Candela Medical to identify practices that use pulse dye laser, and then these practices were contacted by phone to determine characteristics of how they treat the port wine birthmarks. A total of approximately 2,000 dermatologists were included in this survey and about 1,400 practices. They found that 55% utilized non-physicians to perform the procedure, 52% had a minimum age of treatment, and most practices did not use general anesthesia for treatment, though 16% of practices offer general anesthesia if needed. The authors note that pulse dye laser can be performed safely in infants and toddlers, and this does yield to better results, but half of the practices did have an age requirement of 1 year or older.
which highlights the need for further education on the benefits and safety of earlier treatment for port wine birthmarks, which also could reduce the need for general anesthesia.